Good morning. Welcome to the Oregon Zero Suicide podcast series. I'm Dr. Susan Keyes, and today I'm with Dr. Whitney Black from the Department of Psychiatry at Oregon Health Sciences University. Our topic today is measurement-based care to support suicidal patients. But before we begin, Whitney, can you just introduce yourself and tell our audience a little bit about you and your background?
Of course. Thank you for having me today, Susan. A little bit about myself. In my work life, you can mostly find me in the adult ambulatory psychiatry clinic at OHSU working directly with patients. However, I do have time also to indulge other interests, which primarily involve quality improvement. And that's why we're here today. We've been implementing measurement-based care in collaboration with our Zero Suicide Project over the past few years.
Great. Well, and that's exactly what we want to talk about today. Maybe you could help our audience understand exactly what you mean when you talk about measurement-based care. Kind of what is it? How does it work?
Yeah. So measurement-based care is actually an evidence-based practice in mental health, and it's the systematic use of patient-reported outcomes data, which is a fancy way to say things like the PHQ-9 or the GAD-7, to inform care decisions and monitor treatment progress.
And I think you have a unique way of collecting that data here at OHSU. And can you tell us a little bit more about how that process works?
Yeah. So in just a little history about how we got to where we are. So in the past, routine outcomes monitoring has been fairly standard. And that just involves using pen and paper to collect patient symptoms and score them and determine their level of depression, anxiety, depending on their primary symptom concern. However, we know that only about 5 to 10% of mental health providers were actually using that type of practice, even though it is evidence-based and shows that people get have quicker time to response and time to remission with things like anxiety and depression when this practice is used. But people didn't use it because it's hard to work with pen and paper, right? So it takes time out of the clinical appointment. You have to use your, you know, time to then score and graph and kind of norm the scores that you're getting. And really, you want to be spending that time directly with the patient. It's also hard to have the right measure for the right patient at the right time. So what we found at OHSU is now we can use technology to be our friend, right? So with all the recent developments in health information technology, we have implemented a system called a measurement feedback system. And we're actually using a local company called Owl Insights for that technology. And what it does is it will ping a patient with an email and say, your doctor would like for you to complete some measures. They can log in online, complete whatever measures their provider has assigned to them. Again, something like the PHQ-9, GAD-7 are very common ones that people are familiar with. And then the software actually automatically scores, norms, and graphs it for the provider, pings the provider. We can log in and then compare how the person was doing on that day compared to, say, 3 weeks ago when they last filled out their measures.
That's pretty exciting to get that
yeah.
that level of data. Just when I think about that from the patient's perspective, I wonder what kind of technology tools might a patient need in order to be able to comply with these requests?
Yeah, it's actually fairly straightforward. So all a patient needs on their end is basically any web-enabled device. So that could be it's formatted for their phone, tablet, iPad, even just a web browser on the computer. And of course, because we know there's inequities in access to technology like that, most clinics that are using this type of program will have tablets in their offices or kiosks for people to come in 5-10 minutes early and complete the measures. Or if they don't have that, you can revert to pen and paper. But obviously, that takes away some of the benefits of using technology.
And it sounds like what you're doing is not waiting for the patient to necessarily come in to the office, that you have an opportunity to make this request when they're at home. They could complete this on their own time frame.
Exactly. Yeah, that's one of the benefits. we have basically moved some of the monitoring outside of the clinical setting. So we used to have to wait for people to come in and do this on the day of treatment or their appointment. But there's large gaps in there, especially in mental health care. You might not be seeing someone for 3 months, 6 months, depending on how they're doing. And during that time, they might be having increasing symptoms, a relapse of symptoms, and we weren't able to catch that necessarily before. And through using this technology, say, have a patient taking and completing these measures once a month, I can potentially detect relapse or recurrence of symptoms much quicker because they may not recognize it, but the sensitivity of these measures allows us to detect it and say, hey, I noticed you seem to be doing a little bit worse. Do you want to come on in for an earlier appointment? And we can pivot treatment that way.
Very exciting.
Yeah.
Very exciting. And is there some variation in the schedule? Would different patients get different schedules? Some patient might receive an email on a monthly basis, some on a weekly basis. Is that correct?
Yes, that is completely correct. So that's an area where more research needs to be done. Currently, what happens is in our clinic and in most other clinics that are using this type of technology, patients will complete a baseline bundle of measures that kind of are assessing for a variety of potential diagnoses or problems that they're experiencing. And then based on the severity or where they are in their treatment, it's really up to the clinician and clinical decision making about how frequently they may be getting those measures. And to be quite honest, because we don't have a lot of guidance from research about timing, I often include my patients in that decision making. So, you know, I'm a little more worried about you. How about we do this every 2 weeks instead of every month? And then as you get better, maybe every month and kind of space it out from there.
And how does the system work if you need to flag the patient or you need to make that call? What's the internal working there that information, how does that get to you?
Yes. So anytime a patient completes a measure, it will send the provider an email or ping them within the system. You know, there's kind of a queue, work queue that'll say, so-and-so completed these measures, please review. However, most of the time, you know, that's just going to be a depression score or something like that. On occasion, there are more concerning items that may be endorsed, such as endorsing suicidal ideation, thoughts of death, thoughts of self-harm on, for instance, the PHQ-9 question number 9, or maybe on a mania rating scale that someone has gone into, there's concern for mania. So in those cases, there's an extra message attached that has like a red flag on it saying you need to review these results right of way, making sure we know it's urgent. So it will alert us that way, and then we can go in and log in and see, is this a change, something acute we need to address? And then that's where we have set up different care pathways to manage those acute alerts, since we are now detecting those symptoms mm-hmm. without the patient sitting in front of us to be able to decide what to do.
Aha. Uh-huh. Very interesting. And is that red flag system, is that all handled through that software product that you mentioned?
It is handled through that software product. What happens in our clinic, and every clinic works a little bit differently, is whoever sees that first, whether it's a provider or maybe our social worker who is continuously monitoring that inbox of alerts throughout the day, when we notice that, we connect with each other, the social worker and the provider, make a clinical decision based on what we know about that patient. Then either the provider or the social worker will reach out to the patient. That just starts a conversation. I sort of think about that as another way to do a caring contact that we talk about in the zero suicide model. So we have some alert that something's going on with the patient, but instead of waiting for them to miss an appointment or go to a crisis resource, we're saying, hey, we noticed this change. How are you doing? Do you have everything you need? And the social worker will do a little bit of a, you know, over the phone evaluation to see, do we need to refer this patient to the emergency room? Do they know what resources are available? Check in on their safety plan. Do they have that kind of shored up? Or if needed, say, do you need to come in today or in the next few days? And we can move up that appointment to make sure they're getting the care that they need.
Well, it seems that this measurement-based care model has allowed you to shift from being reactive to being proactive.
Great point. Yes, exactly. And I think that's what we're very excited about is we know that, you know, for a lot of problems in mental health like depression, anxiety, they can take a long time to respond to our treatments. You know, it's not like an antibiotic and you feel better necessarily in a few days, although sometimes that's the case. And we know we have big access problems, right? So through this kind of innovative and creative work, if we can be a little more proactive instead of reactive, get people quicker, help them maintain their remission of symptoms, is there, and this needs to be studied, obviously, a way to increase access? Because we're treating people more efficiently, more effectively, monitoring them when they are doing well still, and then able to get those people that are in need into the clinics quicker.
I would imagine that this has some impact on level of patient engagement. Can you just, you know, speak to that, whether you've observed any change in that or any greater uptake in what you're trying to engage about?
Yes. So I think that was actually something that was surprising to me, was the high level of engagement that we've had at OHSU. And I think there are a few key pieces to having that be the outcome. So in the literature, there's sort of mixed results, but there are more and more studies that are pointing to that patients feel more a part of their care. It's like a more collaborative care model, because we say, here are the measures you filled out. This is what I'm seeing. Does that fit with your experience? And, you know, we can kind of, it creates different points of conversation in the treatment. It also is an educational tool, because patients become more familiar with what symptoms actually relate to that diagnosis that we're treating or the problems that they're treating. So they can better identify with their, what their experience of depression is and communicate it in a different way. At OHSU, we have, I think, about 300 patients enrolled in this currently, like at any given point. And we have about an 80% completion rate of measures assigned, which is pretty remarkable when you look at the data out there for uptake of health information technology. And I think the key to that success is that we have the providers actually educate the patients, talk with the patients about why we want them to do this, that this isn't something they fill out to check a box for insurance or some other matter. It's really helps us provide them better care. And then when we actually pull it up and show them the screen and use it in the session, it gives them immediate feedback too and shows how it is a part of the process. Mm-hmm. One of the great things that I've found is that I actually have patients coming in, and if I forget to pull up, you know, the screen and show them their AL measures and scores, they ask me for it because they want to see and they want to compare, like, how much did I decrease on the depression scale or not from last time? And the other cool thing, and I wrote a little commentary about this a couple of years ago, is, you know, I think a lot of the resistance, I might have said before, you know, like, in practice, only 5 to 10% of people are using this, and there's a lot of reasons and barriers to it. But a lot of people feel like, oh, that makes me do more, right? It's sort of like when we had to transition to the electronic medical record from paper and pencil. But what I've learned is that by doing this and having it moved outside of my clinic appointment, I actually feel like I have more time with my patients. And I have more information, like, going into the appointment to be able to help direct that conversation or leave space for them to tell me what's really going on, because I'm not having to run through that symptom checklist in my brain also.
What a really good point, because yeah, time is such a precious commodity.
Right.
And engagement is so, so important also, because, you know, I think it's often common that people drop out of therapy.
Right.
It's sometimes hard work.
Right.
And I think this collaborative model probably helps build that rapport and build that engagement over the longer term.
I think that that is true. And we've had, you know, our social worker who will often call in this kind of caring contact model in that proactive way. She's had so many thank yous. It's been so rewarding for her, because people weren't sure why they were filling it out still or didn't think we would pay attention. And then they get this phone call out of the blue that someone is concerned about them and thinking about them. And that in and of itself, even though it's not
really
studied,
powerful,
is a very powerful therapeutic tool. Like, we do care and we are thinking about you. What do we need to do to help you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Can you tell a little bit more about how you see this measurement system driving the care pathway? I know you've touched on it already, but let's just talk about it a little bit more.
Yeah, so I can kind of outline what the care pathway is. So when someone, specifically for patients at risk for suicide or suicidal ideation, we have several measures in place like the PHQ-9 and then the CSSRS, so on and so forth, that we use. But basically, if someone's going along and they, you know, haven't been depressed or endorsing suicidal ideation, and again, we get that alert that they have endorsed it now, we know from research that we don't know how imminent that risk is, right? But that over the next few months, we need to be trying to modify those risk factors that are contributing to that. So when we can identify them as such, that kind of starts that care pathway with the provider being aware, the social worker being aware, reaching out to them. We make notes in the chart. We're trying to get our EHR to help us a little bit more there to really have a label that will help us, but we're not there yet. But it helps us know how often to see them, how often to reach out to them. Maybe we increase the frequency of the measures. And again, it helps us move people in and out of care at different rates to increase access for those people. I hope that answers the question.
Exactly.
One thing I would add, because we often get this question too, is, well, you know, measure fatigue. So we don't want people to get tired of completing these measures because...
Good point.
We could assign 15 measures to one person if we wanted to. So we try to be very thoughtful when we're assigning these measures, especially in acute situations. And we have to think about, are there risks to this also? There isn't good evidence or research on that, that it could cause harm. But, you know, if we are asking very sensitive questions over and over, we have to be sensitive to that. So we try to, on average, only have people fill out 2 to 4 measures at any given time, and maybe weekly at most, but more often, you know, every other week to monthly, because, yeah, we don't want to drive them away from care by adding this into.
Adding burden or fatigue. I think that's a really, really good point.
Yeah.
And how might you decide which measures to sort of pick and choose? And do you ever rotate some so that you're getting different ones at different times? Or are you pretty consistent with what you ask patients to complete?
Yeah, there are two ways to sort of approach this. One is to try to collect some standard measures for everyone. So with depression and anxiety being so prevalent, you know, even if you have bipolar disorder, we tend to try to do those measures fairly regularly on patients so that we're collecting some standard measures throughout the clinic. And I think that eventually that can help with research and help develop novel treatments. And this worked for that person, you know, who had these specific things going on. But then on top of that, we do tailor specific measures to whatever we're treating or whatever the patient is experiencing. So for bipolar disorder, for instance, they may receive a measure that is for depression and for mania. Obviously, if you just had depression, we wouldn't give you the mania scale. There's specific ones for ADHD, panic disorder. So it does get tailored. A couple of things that are commonly not thought of as being measured, but I think are really important to mention. Every diagnosis basically has, you know, a qualifier that it has to impair function for it to be a diagnosis. So it's really important for people to do measures of functioning and watch, is the functioning of this person improving with treatment as well? So we always do a functioning measure. And then also you can actually measure the therapeutic alliance with your patients.
Oh, tell me more about that.
There are 2 or 3 scales that have been validated for looking at the therapeutic alliance. And it's helpful information because sometimes as clinicians, we overestimate how much someone is improving or how well the relationship is going, because depending on that person and their personality, they may not be disclosing that to us, right? There's evidence out there, especially with adolescents, that they may be more willing to disclose certain types of information, especially information that may cause conflict to a computer or through technology. So by giving people this, they could just say it to us. It's hard to do though, right? So by giving them another way through a measure, through technology, to say, oh, I wish it was like this, or actually I, you know, feel like it's only going about 50%. I wish these things would change. It gives them another way to get feedback to the provider, which often is really helpful. I've heard a lot of different anecdotal stories where someone thought things were going great. Their patient, you know, every 6 months completed one of these measures, and then they realized like they were not giving the patient enough space or something like that to bring things up, and they were able to address that, and then it really did enhance the therapeutic relationship.
Great.
Yeah.
And that's, it couldn't be better.
Yeah, no, exactly. That's it. Absolutely. That's key to all treatment.
When you introduce something new like this into the system, and I assume that this postdates the introduction of the electronic health record.
Yes.
So you're introducing another system change. Can you talk a little bit about how that affected the staff, or just how did that go over? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think anyone working in healthcare knows that when you try to introduce something new and another thing, there's a lot of resistance. And the approach we took was to really be thoughtful. And actually, there's a whole sector of science called implementation science that can be your friend. So my advice to people would be to be thoughtful and intentional and use the research that's been done to support your process, because otherwise we sort of do a little bit here and a little bit there, and we might get a little uptake, but it's not sustained. We're about 2 years into this project and we're expanding. So I think that's the good news. So I think some of the key pieces are to identify leadership, and not just, you know, the physician or the provider, but who are the front desk staff that are going to be talking to patients with this? Who are the intake staff? The people working on the technological side, get a representative from all the key stakeholders so that they feel heard and that their workflow can be understood and that that is taken into consideration as you're developing the workflow throughout the clinic. Because you don't need to own the front desk staff's workflow, right? They need to own it and figure out what works for them, and then we build it together. And to start small and do little iterations, and like when you get it down, then move to the next space and kind of repeat that process. And I think the biggest thing, besides being intentional and sort of organized about it, is education. Like, people need to know why you're doing this and the importance of doing it. And again, not that you're just checking a box or that it's something cool and new to do and that, you know, that's why we should do it, but that it actually can create more space in the appointment, potentially help us be more proactive as opposed to reactive, that it's really providing better care, I think.
You mentioned use what we've learned from implementation science. And are there a couple of gems that maybe you have gleaned that you could share with our audience?
Yeah. So I think leadership and leadership that models what you're asking people to do is important. So if you have someone non-clinical who isn't going to actually be doing this, leading this effort people that are actually clinical, I think there's a mismatch there. So really having someone that's in the trenches and doing it and modeling it and showing that it can be done and they're enthusiastic about it. Some places have actually started making it a mandate that providers are doing this in a condition of care. We haven't moved that far, but those places, there's some places on the East Coast using it in like intensive outpatient and partial hospitalization, different environments than we are using it. And they have like 99% uptake because people understand they want to be there and they're willing to do the work to get the better care. I think
Those are the gems.
Yeah. Good. Leadership, culture, and really modeling it. Yeah.
And one of the things that I think is so important about the movement for zero suicide is that we're really about system change. And when you talked about the workflows for everyone that might come in contact with the patient, and the importance of that person to understand their role and responsibility in terms of this care management, measurement-based care model, you're really talking about system change.
It is, yeah, and it flows from, you know, the patient and through the whole system in our clinic. And the other part of it is, you know, you are doing something specifically for that patient, right? But if we can collect that larger set of data, like I mentioned earlier, for research purposes or quality improvement purposes, we can use that to make additional changes to the system to continue to enhance care, from the level of how often should measures be administered, or is there a better way even still to do it, to using the actual clinical data to, you know, have researchers develop novel treatments or understand more about mental health diseases.
I'm wondering if, as you've looked at any of your data, if you've seen any trends or had any insights in particular about what you're doing and what those might have been.
That's a very good question. I think the answer to that is that we're still so early on, mm-hmm. That it is hard to glean any specific pattern from the data. We keep going back and looking, like, can we tell if we're improving time to response and remission, like we see in the literature, mm-hmm. in our own clinic? It's hard, though, because since no one was really doing this before, it's hard to pull out of mm-hmm. the mm-hmm. EHR. We don't know what the baseline was.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I can say, and I think we delivered some of this information at the Oregon Health Authority Zero Suicide Academy, are, you know, the uptake rates, because that's the first piece, is just getting people to do it. And then you start getting the data and you can start doing something with it. But also that there was fear that with universal screening for suicidal ideation, that all of a sudden we're going to detect all of this and then not have the ability to manage it. And obviously we're dealing with our smaller clinical population. It's very contained. But we have found that it's a very low percentage, actually, that are, you know, for instance, on the PHQ-9 endorsing anything positive. You know, it may end up being less than 10 phone calls a month from our social worker. So
the workload hasn't increased significantly.
Exactly, right. Yeah. I mean, we did develop this new care pathway and implemented, you know, new screening procedures, but it hasn't significantly changed the workflow. And I think actually by having the information, people are a little bit more at ease because we know we're asking and we're at least getting the information instead of just not knowing until someone shows up.
And you have a clear plan for what you're doing once you have that information.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It helps people be responsible.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And get the same consistent care, you know, no matter when your next clinic appointment might be.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. When you think about others who might listen to this and say, gee, that's kind of a system I might like to adapt in my clinic. What advice might you give someone that's looking for something like you're doing here?
Mm-hmm. Start just by doing your research, you know, seeing, you know, what models are available and what may work best in your clinic. You know, if you are in solo practice, you know, there may be different systems, or even pen and paper may be easier than implementing a whole technology. And kind of going around, if you're in a larger organization or medium-sized organization, to test the culture and just start with some education and see what people's feelings about this were, if they see the value in it. So really, again, just starting at that, like socializing the idea, bringing in maybe some speakers to talk about it, and seeing what kind of system you have in place that you're not going to have to uproot everything you're already doing, but how can you kind of overlay something on top, mm-hmm. and start from there?
We're about ready to wrap up.
Okay.
And I wondered if there was any parting comment or thought or anything else you'd like the audience to know about what you're doing here at OHSU and really the unique path you've created for data.
Yeah, I think what we'd like for people to know is that, you know, this is all very early on. We're piloting this. We're not alone. There are definitely people, I'm in communication with people around the country that are noticing this intersection between measurement-based care and suicide prevention work, looking at, you know, can we incorporate safety plans into this, or, you know, how can we make it even more comprehensive? But if you have questions or want to learn more, I'd be happy to serve as a resource. So feel free to reach out to me. And don't be afraid, I guess. You know, like there was a lot of people were concerned about moving things out of the clinical situation or the clinical appointment. What does that mean? How do we handle it? But by banding together, deciding what our values were, we'd rather know these things than not know, and giving it a try, we've realized the benefits of it and that it's just a continuous work in progress. We keep using that data to improve our system and realize where we need to make adjustments to address things.
I like the value that you mentioned. We'd rather know than not know.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of credit to you as a leader.
Thank you.
And to be able to bring a staff together to implement this kind of change. It's not easy. We all know that. And I think it really gives us an excellent example of how to use data to drive patient care.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Thank you really for being with me today, for sharing this really innovative, exciting way for patient care here at OHSU at your psychiatric clinic. I appreciated talking to you.
Yeah, thank you very much for the opportunity. And I'd also like to thank all my team that has helped make this work in our clinics as well. It hasn't only been me. We have a great team of people that are dedicated and willing to see it through. So thank you for acknowledging that. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Okay, this is Susan Keyes, and I'm saying goodbye to you from Oregon Health Sciences University. Thank you very much for listening to our podcast.